Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading and rating. Coming up on this week's programme, we're going to be talking about learning while you sleep. Because there's some research to suggest that you might be able to pick up a new skill or learn a new language, potentially even quit smoking while you're asleep. And this is something that, an idea that's been around for nearly 100 years, but new research suggests it could be possible. First, though, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland and Professor Annie Curtis of RCSI. Ruth, our first story has to do with white hydrogen. What is that?
Yeah, well, you'd be surprised. There's lots of different colours of hydrogen that we talk about now, not the hydrogen itself, which is a clear gas, but really how it's produced. So people might have heard of blue hydrogen, which is made from natural gas, where you capture the CO2 back. So that's seen as one form of quite clean hydrogen. There's also green hydrogen, which is made from splitting water using renewable electricity. But actually, most of the hydrogen that's used for fertilizer production is grey hydrogen, which is made from natural gas without capturing the carbon back. But this story is about white hydrogen. And white hydrogen, sometimes called gold hydrogen, is naturally produced inside the Earth. So it comes from various different geological processes. The most well-studied way that this is formed is from serpentinization, which is a reaction where water interacts with iron-rich rocks deep inside the earth. So we've always known these deposits were there. But we've always thought they were just too small and too difficult to extract to make white hydrogen a potential fuel source.
So just to be clear, the hydrogen itself is just normal hydrogen.
Yes.
We're calling white because we're talking
exactly
about
how
like green
produced
fuels.
The colour just refers to how it's produced. But it was back in 2012, there was a hydrogen reserve found in Mali. And that natural reserve has been used since about 2012 to power a whole village because it's a natural reservoir where the hydrogen is very clean and it's actually slightly renewing as well as a pool of hydrogen. So that's been used. So the number of companies now exploring, looking for potential clean hydrogen deposits has gone up. And this is new research from the University of Toronto. It was published in the Proceedings of the National Academies of Sciences this week. And what they've done here is they've gone to a mine in Ontario and they've come up with a new way of measuring this hydrogen reserve. So they did a number of boreholes around the mine and took a lot of measurements and they were able to estimate the flow of hydrogen coming out. And it's about 8 kilograms of hydrogen annually per borehole. It doesn't sound like a lot, but they did about 15,000 boreholes.
Oh.
So when you add all of that together, they estimate there could be over 140 tons of hydrogen produced each year. And that is enough to generate nearly 5 kilowatts of energy, which would be enough to power about 400 homes, or indeed to power the mine, which is very, very close to where they've done this exploration. So this is very interesting because the way that they've actually identified how much hydrogen is there and how they could potentially extract it does open up opportunities in other areas where we think there is probably hydrogen that it could be extracted. And, you know, there is a lot of hydrogen under the earth. So the US Geological Survey estimates there could be more than 5 trillion metric tons of this kind of hydrogen around the world. And obviously only a tiny amount of that could be recoverable.
But don't tell me nothing's for free. Nothing's for free in this life.
Yep.
I mean, obviously hydrogen is a clean fuel, but is it a bad idea to be boring 15,000 holes in a mine and just letting hydrogen that was there for millions of years to sort of seep out? Have we thought about this properly?
I mean, it is a finite resource still. This is built up over billions of years, just like fossil fuels. But I guess if you think about the situation that we're in where we need time, even if we could only get 1 or 2% of this hydrogen out from under the earth and use it, you know, that would be all our power needs for the next 200 years, even if you projected, the increase in demand for electricity. So, you know, there may be certain areas, there's certain geological formations where there might be hydrogen that could be tapped into. And I mean, the market would suggest people think it's viable because the number of companies trying to find it has gone up quite significantly.
Well, like a local hydrogen stream just powering your village would be pretty cool. As long as, you know, it's safe, it's not a dangerous fuel, but and it's clean as well. So interesting. Our second story has to do with sleep, Annie.
Oh, Jonathan, how I love this topic, I have to say. So this was a great study that was published in Nature only a couple of days ago. And what they did is they followed about 500,000 people between the age of 37 and 84 years old to see, you know, in terms of how much sleep they got.
Who's they now?
They, the UK Biobank.
Okay.
Yep. To see how much sleep they got and sort of what was the consequence of that. And what they showed was, in terms of kind of detrimental effects, sleep follows this U-shaped curve. So basically, if you think about the graph on the bottom, on the X, it shows the number of hours of sleep. And then on the Y, then it shows kind of detrimental things like disease and stuff. So what they found is that sleep follows a U-shaped curve. So in the middle, it's kind of like Goldilocks porridge. This is where you want to be, okay, down at the bottom. And what they found is that number of hours is between 6.4 and 7.8. So let's just call it 6 to 8, okay?
Yeah.
So that's where you want to be in terms of the most sort of beneficial sleep, which was surprising to me because the general recommendation is 7 to 9 for adults. So, you know, we can manage better maybe in a little bit less sleep. But then on the right-hand side, this is when you have too much sleep. Now, we kind of knew for a while that excessive sleep actually wasn't too good for us. But now we really know what's going on. And in terms of excessive sleep, what it is it's not like you're generating new disease. It's like it's enhancing disease that you already have, right?
Too much sleep. So it's like it's bad to have too little sleep, but it's also bad to have too much sleep, and that's associated with worse disease outcomes.
Absolutely. Now the difference, and they have some tips about what you do if you have short sleep versus long sleep, which I think is really interesting. But so the long sleep, the excessive sleep, is associated with sort of disease that you're already maybe susceptible for having, right? And that could include depression, chronic inflammation, and neurodegenerative disease. Because we know if you have too much sleep, I always think about sleep like a dishwasher, right? So when you sleep in the nighttime, the dishwasher goes on and all the things kind of flow through from the brain into kind of the periphery and the kidney, and then it gets sent out. So if you have too much sleep, you don't put the dishwasher on the highest cycle. Okay, so you don't
get... We're struggling with this metaphor.
I'm struggling with this. Sometimes I think you can, you know, drive the arse out of an analogy, and that's what I've just done. Okay, So then if you have too little sleep, again, what you get is, you know, you sort of get metabolic disease, less amount of glucose being taken up into the tissues.
Okay, so give us the very quick tips for
So if you have too little sleep, what you want to do, like that's less than 6 hours, what you want to do, and this is kind of feeds into circadian rhythms, you want to have consistent timing of when you go to bed. You want to have lots of morning light, again, about your body clock. You want to have caffeine that's cut off after lunch. You want to stop drinking alcohol 3 hours before bed. And that's it. So for the excessive sleep, then you want to look at a number of, say, your blood markers, so like vitamin D, CRP. And then you want to look at the meds that might be causing you to sleep more. So like antihistamines.
Okay. Our third story, Ruth, has to do with the MOA. What is a MOA?
So a MOA is a bird that has gone extinct. They've been extinct for about 600 years. They were native to New Zealand. Think of a massive emu, like very, very tall. They could be about 3 metres tall. But the reason that MOAs are in the news is because our favourite de-extinction company, Colossal Biosciences, says that it has developed an artificial egg, which it could potentially use to bring back to life the MOA, or indeed the dodo.
Wow.
So people may have heard of Colossal Biosciences before. They were in the news last year claiming to have de-extincted the dire wolf. Now, they didn't really do that. You know, they modified a modern grey wolf to make it have some features that look a little bit more like what we think a dire wolf looked like. And I think here we're in danger of more hype than substance as well. So this wasn't published. It was a press release. So probably warning signs go up there straight away.
Yep.
But it has been really widely covered. So what they did was they've actually hatched 26 chickens out of an artificial egg. So, I mean, they call it an egg, but it's not really an egg. It's more of an egg shell. So it's kind of a sort of system, a silicone membrane, which is permeable. And that's the key thing for an egg. An egg has to be permeable so oxygen can get into the developing chick. And then there's kind of a support cup around it. And I did go down a little bit of a YouTube video hole last night. You can actually apparently hatch a chick in cling film. If you really want to. So this may not be such a big look on YouTube. This may not be such a big breakthrough. But a lot of those, even though you can hatch a chick in lots of different types of membranes, they're often not very healthy because they don't get enough oxygen. So, I mean, while this is a press release, it may be interesting because the idea of an artificial egg, while it might not be helpful to bring back the moa, and many people in New Zealand do not want that to happen, it might be helpful when you think about more ethical farming practices, or indeed to support species that are still alive who would need additional support.
Very cool. Annie, our final story, old people who are unhealthy, it's their own fault, says the research.
Yeah, so this was a study that was produced from the Oxford Longevity Project, and it was basically an interdisciplinary panel where you had a number of experts, medicine, physiology, etc. And basically what they produced was that 80% of ill health is solely due to the individual and the choices that they make. So, you know, we have this idea that as individuals age, you know, they kind of lose their strength and their capability to exercise, and this would actually counter that. The reason I didn't love it is it didn't really show and talk about the inequities that can occur between people. And we know that poverty is probably one of the biggest ones. And poverty used to be declining, but it's actually beginning to increase again post-COVID. So that's why it was a controversial point. And I think, you know, there's other issues as well that will affect it, you know, in terms of pollution, in terms of, you know, home issues around home, and even sleep will affect somebody's health.
Right. So, yeah. So it's not really their fault, but actually it is. Decisions play a major factor in the outcome of elderly health. I suppose that's not massively surprising in some respects. Professor Annie Curtis and Dr. Ruth Freeman, thank you so much. Welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. Now, in 1932, inventor Alwa Benjamin Salinger patented the psychophone, a phonograph hooked up to a timer which could play recordings to a person while they slept that would supposedly help them learn skills and behaviours subconsciously. The tantalising prospect that one might be able to speak Chinese or quit smoking with little or no effort was surely worth forking out the $235 asking price for. Back in 1932, that was a hell of a lot of money. Unfortunately, the idea had no scientific merit. But where the psychophone failed, new research may succeed. Karen Conkley is a dream scientist at the University of Cambridge. She joins me now. Karen, welcome to the program. You are a dream researcher. Can you tell us what that is?
Yes. So I study the neuroscience of dreams. And so in a lot of my studies, I'm doing sleep research where we put electrodes on people's heads to measure their sleep stages. And then we ask them to do specific things in their dreams, and then we wake them up and ask what they were dreaming about.
Okay. And we have talked about lucid dreamers on this program, and your work is really interesting. So I'm not going to spend too much time on explaining what a lucid dreamer, but really quickly, these are people who are able to realize they are in a dream, and that makes them interesting to people like you.
Yes, because they're within the dream and realize that they're dreaming, it's a really valuable tool for science because they can do specific tasks and listen for instructions, even though they're completely asleep.
So tell me about your research. What sort of experiments have you done and how did you go about designing them?
Yeah. So in one study, we demonstrated that lucid dreamers could communicate with experimenters in real time. So you might have experienced an alarm clock getting incorporated into your dream. And we took advantage of that phenomenon to quietly present people with questions such as quiet math problems or yes or no questions, or, you know, even tactile questions like how many times did we tap you on the hand? And then dreamers responded from within the dream by, for instance, looking left, right for each number in their response. And this eye movement pattern we can detect in their sleeping body, and it really stands out over what would normally happen during a REM sleep dream.
So someone is in their, this is like Inception, someone is in their dream and you give them some sort of stimulus and they're aware and conscious enough to understand that you're trying to communicate with them and try and communicate back, but they're definitely asleep.
Yes, and it is funny because they don't hear everything that we ask. They only hear it every now and then. It's like these transient moments when people can be aware and connected to these two worlds at the same time. And a lot of the times they're just within the dream and they can't perceive it, the questions.
Right. And so how statistically sure are you that this isn't just a clever hands sort of, you know, coincidence sort of thing? Like, how sure are you that you're actually getting proper results from people as opposed to just noise or chance?
Yeah, we're completely sure. First of all, the signals that people give in dreams are like they barely ever happen by coincidence. And so another thing you could look at is, were their answers correct or incorrect? And so almost every answer that dreamers gave to the questions was the correct answer. And there was like extremely few incorrect answers. So it shows that the movements that the dreamers were giving weren't just spurious or mistakes. They were definitely hearing the question and answering correctly. And then they woke up and would remember it. And we could tell from their physiology, that they're following all the rules of being asleep. Their body is paralyzed. Their brainwaves are asleep. So they're definitely asleep.
So then how do they, because, you know, obviously you're hallucinating when you dream. How do these questions manifest themselves in people's dreams? Is it a voice of God scenario? Is it embodied in a person or an animal? Or how do they hear these questions to answer?
Yeah, I think that's one of the most amazing things. Sometimes they hear it as though it's just coming from somewhere completely else, but other times it is incorporated in the dream. For instance, there was a dreamer who felt that they heard the voice of like a movie narrator or the voice of God overlaid on their dream. In another example, the dreamer was in a car and the car radio was broadcasting the question. We've also asked questions with lights, flashing lights, and the dreamer like saw the lights in the room flashing, and then they saw a fish tank with the lights flashing. And so there are these really cool examples of the sentences that we're presenting getting incorporated in really idiosyncratic ways, depending on what the dreamer is experiencing at the time.
That is so cool. That is trippy.
It's fun.
Talk to me about difficult tasks then. Tell me about the tree puzzle.
Yeah. So in a next study, we gave dreamers unsolved puzzles. And so we actually gave the puzzles when they were awake. So an example would be, how do you plant four trees exactly equidistant from one another? You can't plant them in a straight line because the trees on the far ends are too far. And you can't plant them in a square because the trees at the diagonal are farther apart because of the Pythagorean theorem. So how do you plant them? And so we gave participants all sorts of puzzles like this one. And when they were awake, they were working on the puzzles until they kind of became stumped. They reached an impasse where they just couldn't progress towards the solution any longer. And as they listened to each puzzle, they were hearing a musical backing track unique to that puzzle. Then the participants went to sleep, and we woke them up at 4 a.m. and did a training to help promote lucid dreams. And these participants were already experienced lucid dreamers. And then when the participants returned to sleep, we presented sounds from only two of the four unsolved puzzles in their dreams. And we said, if you hear the puzzle sound in your dream, continue working on that puzzle. So you could ask a dream character or the dream itself to work with you on the puzzle. You could enter the puzzle scenario in the dream, try to find those trees. And so kind of try to work with your subconscious mind to get more information about solving the puzzles. And so what we found is that when we presented the cues, sleepers did dream of those puzzles that we were cueing. And if they dreamed of a puzzle, they were more likely to solve it the next morning. And so the answer to that trees puzzle, which one dreamer did dream of in her dream, she was in a tattoo parlor and she saw the trees tattoo on someone's arm. And she realized that you have to do it in 3D. You have to plant the third tree on a hill so that they're in like a pyramid shape. And that's the way that you can plant the trees equidistant from one another.
Thank you. Oh, my God. I'm trying to figure that out. But I do. Yeah. I do. I was like, what is the answer to that question? Oh, in a pyramid. Okay, great. So,
yeah.
when you, I think a lot of people were also trying to figure that out. So it is possible then to take a task and give it to someone, and then why do we think that they might be better equipped to solve problems that they can't solve as well when they're conscious, when they're asleep?
Yeah, well, that was the original motivation for the study. We had hoped that all the dreamers would solve them when they were asleep. And the rationale was that you know, dreams are a time when information could be like really restructured, where you can kind of take weak associations and mix up, kind of like flatten the curve of what you would normally think about, so that things that are more distant or like a new way of thinking about things, a new metaphor, might become more readily apparent to you. And so we thought that because REM sleep is associated with this restructuring and this abstract thinking, that it might help with insight. And also, of course, because of all the anecdotes across history of people coming to these important insights in their dreams, like Mary Shelley thought of the plot of Frankenstein in a dream, and the structure of the periodic table of elements came from a dream. And so we kind of wanted to test that empirically. And actually, in the lab, most people didn't solve the puzzles in their dreams. They would have a dream that just loosely related to the puzzle, and yet the next day when they worked on it, if they had dreamt of it, they solved it more quickly.
Give me a mountain with lots to do. Give me the sunshine, give me a dew. Give me something simple and true. All I need is sunshine and a cool refreshing mountain.
Grab some friends and an ice-cold Mountain Dew today.
Mountain Dew!
Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, you only, how many people do you have in the study?
20 people. Each one did the experiment for 2 nights.
Yeah, so it's a small sample size. I mean, it's really interesting, but it's a small sample size. If you did it across a population, you might find there are some people that are more prone to that.
Totally.
Did you find, even in that small group, that there were some people who were just really good, and did they have anything in common with the other ones who performed well?
Yeah. So in the study, we actually had two groups. There was a group of 12 dreamers that really dreamt the most of the cued puzzles. And when we presented the cues, their dreams, you know, responded and incorporated the cued puzzles. And so overall, there was an effect, but it was really driven by those 12 people. And so for those 12 people who tended to be, you know, the ones who were more successful having lucid dreams and hearing the instructions and things like that, they were more likely to solve the cued puzzles. Whereas in the overall sample, the sounds themselves didn't actually predict solving. It was the dreams that predicted solving. So there's kind of like three variables there that are all interacting. But yeah, I think being a good lucid dreamer, being able to hold that, you know, intention in mind of what you're going to dream about. And of course, we also had a lot of variability in the which puzzles participants happened to be stuck on. Like, it could be that some participants, like, no matter what their dreams did, were always going to solve a particular puzzle because it wasn't that hard for them. And other participants, like, might have found some puzzles, like, insolvable. And so even if they dreamed about it, they wouldn't solve it. So there was definitely, you know, a lot of opportunities for noise in the measures. But nevertheless, we did find that these effects.
And so if we could find a way of, you know, because this is only 2 nights, say you did this for 10 nights, maybe, you know, your analytical skills could, you know, could benefit from some sort of percentage bump, or maybe your ability to be more empathetic, or your target practice, or whatever it is that, you know, you're, if you're talking about physical skills or thinking skills, the question is this a good idea? I mean, like, should we, we don't even know what sleep is for, right?
Yeah. Yes. Well, it's interesting. In that study, we actually had people fill out a dream diary for a week and a half after the study. And we found that people continued dreaming of the puzzles, and they did several times solve them in their dreams at home. Another puzzle is the question GESG. What does that mean? And one dreamer had this dream, and she was like, my dream was very strong on breakfast. Maybe that's the solution to the puzzle, GESG. And the solution is scrambled eggs. It's like the letters in the word eggs that are scrambled. So it definitely affects people's dreams. And I think that it's important to not over-engineer dreams and to remember that, you know, a big reason why we did this study was to try to understand why we dream in the first place. What is this state actually good for? And until we really understand everything that dreams are doing, I think it is a bit dangerous to try to like change them all the time, especially with sounds, because they might be doing things that we're not accounting for. And maybe we don't need to solve problems in our dreams tonight. Maybe we really need to process a difficult emotional memory we had that day or something like that. And so I think that dreams have an intelligence all their own, and we should respect that. But I still think it's exciting to be able to make scientific progress on understanding them, and also to help when people's dreams go awry, such as if you have PTSD or traumatic nightmares. Like, there's definitely a lot of linkages between mental health and altered dreaming. And so it could be a really good intervention time for people who struggle with mental health.
Yeah, I mean, the things we do know is a good night's sleep gives you better outcomes on the next day in terms of cognitive tasks. We also know in terms of mood, sleep, you know, so like the evidence seemed to suggest that it's doing some sort of filtering or cleaning or some sort of processing, that when we don't have that dream, if we stay up all night, that ability to function is not there. So it seems like there's some sort of repair or maintenance work that's being done by sleep, but we haven't seen that in the brain yet.
Yeah. And, you know, it's one thing to study the function of sleep, but the extent to which dreams contribute to the functions of sleep is an even more unknown question.
Right. Yeah. I suppose, I mean, perhaps dreams are the hold music to the brain while the brain does the work, and the dreams is just the sort of entertaining your brain while the hard work is done. So it's difficult to tell if dreams have any function, right? Because it's hard to separate dreams from sleep.
Yeah, for sure. And it could be. But one kind of argument against that, and kind of the reason why we did that study, is because if you could say that the specific content of someone's dream is more informative to what that period of sleep is doing than the overall night of sleep or the amount of sleep or any other physiological thing about that sleep, it would kind of show you, it would provide decent evidence that the dreams are important. Like, you might have this exact amount of sleep and REM sleep and blah, 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 but if your dream pertains to this specific puzzle, you're more likely to solve it. So, I mean, it's an argument that the dream itself is relevant.
Yeah, for sure. Well, what about physical tasks? Is your research, you know, does it cover that at all? Like, the, you know, some repetitive tasks can be really useful in terms of, you know, building finger agility, for example, for piano, or for, you know, for steadiness, you know, holding a rifle, whatever it is. Has there been any research in that area that suggests that, you know, that our dreams are helpful in improving us at these tasks?
So we know that sleep is really good at helping you improve in, if you learn a song on the piano, you kind of reach a plateau where you're not improving. And then after a night of sleep, you can play it much better the next day. And that's been established. But the question is, are dreams contributing? And so I have this friend, Claudia, who did a cool study where she gave people a really complex motor task. It was learning a flying virtual reality game. So you're like virtually flying through these targets, and it's a kind of a difficult motor task. And she found that if people dreamed of the task, and particularly if they dreamed of the kinesthetic elements of the task, their dream involved these bodily movements and the sense of balance, that predicted their improvement the next day. And so it seems like, as opposed to rote or repetitive learning, dreams might be particularly suited for kind of weird types of motor tasks. Like, REM sleep is associated with like acrobatic trampolining. And so it might be these like really new things that your dreams and REM sleep are particularly good at helping you with during the night.
Is it easy to control for dreams in your work? I mean, is it possible to have two participants where someone sleeps but doesn't reach REM sleep where we typically dream? Because aren't there different states of sleep? Like, could you hold someone in a non-dreamlike sleep and compare outputs
that way? There are some studies that do that you could, for instance, manipulate the time of a nap. So like a nap in the early morning is more likely to have more REM sleep than a nap in the afternoon. But one thing to remember is that dreams actually happen in all stages of sleep.
And really?
Yes, dreams. And so like the function of REM sleep and the function of dreams are overlapping, but not quite the same. And so what we've tried to do in our studies is say, all right, everybody's having, you know, roughly the same amount of REM sleep, the same sleep structure. And can we, within each person, manipulate what they dream about? So you're going to dream of these two puzzles and not these two puzzles. And so that way you have stronger power, because it's the same person within their dreams. You're saying dream of some topics and not others. And that enables you to make a stronger conclusion about the content of the dream specifically having a function.
What's next for your lab then? What are you hoping to look at?
Yeah, well, I just moved to the UK and I'm starting a new project about, you know, when I was running these studies, I would stay up all night long and present questions to people in lucid dreams, and they would like sometimes hear them and sometimes not. And to me, it was like this like communication across dimensions. Like, how is it that sometimes they can perceive me and sometimes they can't, even though they're attending the whole time? It's like this super mystery. And so we're trying to understand why sleepers in general and lucid dreamers can hear you sometimes and not other times.
So you're looking for lucid dreamers in the UK, or do you already have, do you know
who they are? We are looking for some. If anybody wants to come to Cambridge to participate in the study over the next 2 years.
Okay, well, I mean, it's not that far from Ireland, so,
yeah.
You know, if you are a lucid dreamer, please do let us know how you know that, because I find this whole subject absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, when you wake up in the morning, you'll know before you wake up, right? Because you'll be in your dream and you'll be like, oh my gosh, this is a dream. And if you can control it and direct your attention, influence what happens next, then you're probably lucid dreaming.
I think I had that once. And I decided to fly.
Yeah, that's an excellent, flying. Excellent activity.
It was
awesome.
It was
about 50% of people have one at least once in their life.
Really lovely speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Karen Conkley is a dream scientist at the University of Cambridge.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, time to look back at some of your comments from last week. Jer texted in. We were talking about birds stealing from nests. And there are certain birds that that steal a lot from each other in South America. And Jer says, really enjoy your show each week. I was listening today about birds stealing from each other. I have a number of big sycamore trees close to the house. I've noticed a number of times over a number of years of crows stealing twigs from other nearby nests. As you described, they were on the same level, like the trees would touch or be very close to each other at the top of trees. Because one of the things in the study was that the stealing kind of happened at a certain height, which was kind of weird. Like if a nest was up high in a tree, it wouldn't be robbed by a bird that was from the same species lower down in the tree or in another tree. Kind of gets you thinking, is there actually some sort of unrecognized hierarchies that maybe if you're at level D, you don't go stealing from level A at the top of the tree. That's just kind of hypothesizing. That wasn't shown in the study, by the way. Anyway, Jer says, often I saw two crows busy building a nest or rebuilding last year's one, and a crow in a tree nearby swooping in and stealing from that nest while the pair are out gathering. That goes on for a while before the pair realize and catch out the robber. He'll break loose after that. Robber never goes back again. A very observant person, like most people, just look out there when they go, there's a crow. And Jer's out there watching the socioeconomic dynamics of crows. Nice catch, Jer. Thank you. We were talking about planet formation and how Uranus got its rings. And Pat from Oranmore says, the red ring around Uranus, seriously? How did nobody comment on that? Because we're not puerile, Pat. Because we're not children. Well, no, that's not true. We are actually children. We're very, very immature. But if you listen to the program regularly, which, Pat, you've been listening to the show for years, you must know, I'm a bit ick. I'm ick about that end of the body. I just don't like talking about it ever. That's it from us on this episode. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan and Aidan McKelvey. Rory Gavin was on podcast. Hugo De Silva was on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.